Okay, here's how Miro works. See, it's amazing.
What's everyone doing at David's desk?
Ever since marketing started using Miro's collaborative online whiteboard, he thinks all our other teams should sign up.
Why?
He says Miro's making his meetings disappear. And if every team gets on it, that means even less meetings. They're using Miro for brainstorms, mind maps, customer research.
So could we use Miro instead of having another 100 meetings for every round of feedback?
Yep. You can comment, react to ideas, even leave a recording on the board.
And what about presentations?
There are Miro templates for that.
How do you know so much about Miro?
I've actually been using it all along. I just used a Miro board to plan the best vacation.
Okay, I'm on board.
See how Miro users save up to 80 hours every year by meeting less and doing more. Get on board at Miro.com with 3 boards free forever. That's Miro.com.
Hi guys, Pete and Rich here. The Boys in the Band podcast is back. But before we get into the main show, we've just got to tell you about a cool deal from our sponsors, Beer 52.
Yep, they've come up with a great deal for listening to the Boys in the Band podcast. So if you fancy a free case of 8 craft beers from Beer 52, just go to beer52.com/band. And all you have to do is cover the postage cost of $5.95.
And as well as that free case, you also get signed up to Beer 52's beer club, the largest in the world with over 150,000 active members. And each month, members are sent a case with a different theme, as well as a magazine and a snack. You can, of course, pause or cancel at any time, but it's well worth trying out.
So head over to beer52.com/band for that offer, and we hope you enjoy the upcoming pod. Hello, Pete and Rich here with another edition of My Naughty's number one album on the Boys in the Band podcast. And this week we've got the My Naughty's number one album choices of Boy Heel Boy.
Yeah, well, three of the four. We had all four on the long podcast, didn't we? But poor old Pete in his mobile office, halfway home from the dump, lost a bit of signal, so I was unable to complete this challenge. But we got the selections of Chris, Shaz and Kev as well, so it was good fun. And just like the longer pod on Saturday was good fun as well, Rich. We I think we spoke quite a bit in the intro about how much we enjoyed doing that pod, and it was great to see such a positive reaction as well. You know, we said this was their first interview in 13 years, and so obviously a lot of love for them. Still quite a lot of followers on their Facebook page, and there's lots of lovely comments in the comments section of the podcast when we dropped it on there as well. So yeah, people still got a lot of love for that band.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got quite a few people getting in touch with us and saying how pleased they were to hear from the band and fond memories of them. Really enjoyed the comment that got to us that from a lady who's still got Susie as her ringtone in the morning. So could definitely see that one as a good wake me up.
There's actually someone commenting called Susie as well, and I was starting to wonder whether this was the Susie.
But, yeah, could be.
Perhaps not. Well, so that was Boy Kill Boy, obviously music that people were still very fond of. But what were Boy Kill Boy into back in the day? What are they into now from that era? Let's find out with their My Naughty's number one selection.
Okay, so we've got Boy Kill Boy with us, who are going to choose their My Naughty's number one albums. So, guys, we like to reminisce with the bands that we get on the podcast about bands, albums from that era that stand out in their memory, their favourite albums. So, who'd like to kick us off? What album do you treasure from that decade?
I'll go first. I think, for me, Interpol, Turn on the Bright Lights, was a game changer, and it sort of encapsulated a lot of sounds that I enjoyed from previous decades, even. Like, it sort of had the darkness of The Cure and things like that, but at the same time that punchiness, that the drums, that just pure pop power, pop drums, that perhaps the Strokes kind of really brought in with them as well. And it just to me. And they were really cool on stage, and they just looked great. And, you know, I think we were actually in New York. We had one of those gigs where we were in New York, and we just sort of ended up in this group, and more bands were sort of joining in with us, like Mystery Jets were sort of in our little group, and then we're going somewhere. We're heading off to a party, like an after-hours party somewhere, which is someone, like local fixer person was kind of leading us to this party. And there was a strange looming character in our group who turned out to be the bass player of Interpol. And I'm sort of glad I didn't didn't know that. Otherwise, I would have probably like gushed all over. Do you know what I mean? That for me was a really cool band and really understated as well. Yeah. So
just me, like Interpol were a band that probably had quite a lot of influence on other bands that followed the scene. So I think that album was out sort of quite early in the decade, wasn't it? About 2001, 2002. Yeah. And probably like the Strokes, they probably had a knock-on effect inspiring a lot of the guys who maybe had success more like 2005, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah, good shout. Yeah, so that's what I mean. I think they're kind of understated and you know, clearly the singer is not going to be like working the PR machine, you know, like sort of, do you know what I mean? And obviously when the Strokes came in, you know, without a shadow of doubt, just changed everything. I mean, you know, I don't know, boys. I don't want to hog it. What do you reckon? Was anyone going to talk about the Strokes? Shaz?
it's a difficult one, really, that question, because at the time we were so in what we were doing with touring, and we were basically at a gig almost every night, and you know, watching support bands, constantly sort of sound checking, recording, writing, watching other bands, seeing what was going on. And so after all that, I don't remember spending that much time on my own, you know, with a pair of headphones or whatever, listening to an album, if I'm honest. So a lot of my memories of kind of, I suppose, the best albums of the time were just through experience rather than the songwriting itself. Like, and I guess the Strokes fits into that, or maybe even like the Killers, and albums like that, where we would just walk into house parties and those songs would be blaring and the memory would come with that and the whole feeling of all of that. So I guess, maybe the Killers and Strokes are probably two of the albums that define that feeling.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I definitely hear what you're saying there. They're classic house party bands. They're on every house party you went to in that era. They were always on. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember listening a lot to the Foo Fighters as well at the time, but, you know, yeah, it was more the experience of those bands. Yeah.
80s Matchbox, Beeline Disaster, Horse of the Dog.
Yes, that's one you mentioned.
One of the most important albums that decade for me. Most definitely.
What did you like about that one so much?
I just thought it broke all the rules, and it was just totally raucous, sludgy, dirty, brilliant. I just loved it, and it's kind of like zombie music. I wasn't kind of well versed with that sort of, I don't know why, is it kind of rockabilly type backdrops to it? I don't even know really, but so it was really fresh to my ears. I don't know, they might have taken great influences from lots of other bands, but for me it was just very fresh. So loved it, absolutely loved it, and like I said, loved them live as well.
I'm kind of similar to Shaz. I wasn't getting deep into any albums. I probably listened to the NME compilations more than anything else. So I was keeping up with kind of what the hot new bands were and stuff, but I probably didn't have time to delve much deeper. So I'm probably not very helpful here.
Kev, what was your favourite band then? If you were struggling to pick out an album, was there any of those bands you discovered on the NME compilations who really stuck with you?
I mean, there was a band I was really into at the time. I don't know if you've heard of them. They were called Blur. Probably popular a little bit before that, but they were still doing stuff in that era, in that decade, like Think Tank and stuff like that. And Think Tank was one that I would probably actually turn to quite a lot, because at the time that Think Tank was being recorded, I was working with an artist called Banksy. He was literally sketching some of the covers of it next to me while I was building his websites and the artwork.
No way.
Just kind of sketching out the ideas and playing me bits of the tracks kind of months and months and months ahead of release. So I kind of got quite attached to that one. So Good Song is always actually one of my go-tos.
Yeah.
I think Good Song, yeah. I mean, you know, Blur obviously love all of the Britpop stuff that they did. You know, Girls and Boys was on the radio earlier. Just absolutely classic, I guess you call it indie pop music. It just fills dance floors whenever it's played. But Good Song, yeah, when that came out, or Out of Time, just so such good songwriting. But just touching on that artwork there, and not to try and work out who Banksy is through you again, but talking about the importance of artwork on albums, obviously that's quite iconic on that Think Tank album. I always think of the Boy Kill Boy font as well. That's quite distinctive as on all of your music. That jumps out to me as, yeah, this is, you know, Boy Kill Boy font. So, Kev, maybe from that artistic point of view, what are your views on how the art and branding of the albums of that era sort of married up and how important they were to get that right together as well?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the font at this point, because our mate Smith first came up with that, and he basically copied the Blur font to make Boy Kill Boy. So when the label saw it, they thought, well, we've got to justify changing this slightly to get our new designers doing it. So they just fattened it up a little bit. But it was really interesting because the guys who did it, I wish I could remember their name. They were really, really good.
Big Active.
A lot of albums at the time. Big Active, yeah.
Big Active.
And they had a definite template for what their covers would look like. The logo, like a really clear font and a clear name across the top, a big striking image in the middle. Simple as that, really. For us, I think there was a tension actually at the time between, do we go down the route of this big striking image that's going to contribute well to a campaign and look really interesting? And the imagery was very much from Chris's mind and kind of evolved from there. Or should we have our faces on it? And there were arguments as to, well, no one knows who you are, what you look like. And there were arguments against it of like, well, do they really need to? Do they need to see these things? I think that we had quite a striking visual for album one, definitely. And Chris, I don't know if you want to kind of talk more around that, because it definitely came from you.
I mean, I think, do you remember when it was the transition from the first album to then Stars in the Sea? We did feel like we'd sort of lost a little bit of that. We hadn't really presented ourselves as people, you know, as members of this little team that we're in. So I think that was where we, you know, we employed a good friend to take the photos from then on, and try and kind of try and include imagery that all of us could resonate with, and that would crop up in our videos and things like that. It was like and so that way we sort of became a little bit more hands-on. Am I right to say that we were never like one of the most natural, comfortable bands in front of the camera? Like, you know, some bands have just got it, and even doing these interviews, like, I totally cringe at what I say. I can't ever listen back to them, but you know, like getting a camera stuffed in your face, we tried doing like some kind of live, you know, mates come on tour with you and just start filming stuff, and it's just like, as soon as you've got a video camera stuck in your face, it's so hard to keep being normal, you know what I mean? So it's just there. And then the photography thing was a bit like that as well, so maybe we kind of sidestepped that in the first album and just stuck to this very strong imagery that then, you know, slightly diversified as they went along the ace, you know, the singles that were released.
I think when pictures were being taken around the first album of us, the label were, they recognised that we were maybe 5 years older than some of the other bands around, or maybe a few more than that, I don't know. But we were a little bit older, and they would instruct the hair and makeup people to cake on the makeup. They'd get the hair straightened out. I've got very straight hair, and they'd straighten it. I'd be like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? Like, trust me. And then you'd look appalling in the pictures. It would look really, really silly. So at the point, there was a definite point where I think Chris turned to the label and was like, right, we're going to go a bit more natural from here. So can you stop it? Back off.
Stop it.
Yes. Come on, we're adults. We can make our own.
That on my face.
And yeah, that was definitely sort of made things feel a little bit more relaxed when it came to that side.
The whole image thing is so twisted, because on one hand, like, you've got this opportunity to get out there and present yourself to the world, and you know, for me, it was like, I was a kid, it was like Adam Ant and then like Prince, and you know, I mean, obviously I'm not going to dress up like that, but you know, you want to like get your threads on a little bit. Do you know what I mean? Like, so that was like important. But then you do like an NME shoot where they'd get you dressed up as a certain theme. Like, I think for us, they were doing like this film theme. And so they were like, right, you're going to do Reservoir Dogs. That's your theme. And we're like, is it? Oh, okay. So they kind of wanted us in like white shirts and black sort of suits. And we wanted us to look a bit like edgy, like, you know. And, you know, but that turned out to be like one of the big pictures that we introduced ourselves to the NME readers. So they must have just thought, you bunch of wankers, you know what I mean? You look back at that picture, you don't actually dress like that. But yeah, again, it's like, you know, you want to be down surf, you want to be natural, but you want to make a bit of an effort sometimes as well. What did you say, Shaz? You always had a phrase for that, didn't you?
Oh, I love dressing up.
Dress for the job you want or something like that, was it?
For the job you want, not for the job you've got.
There you go.
Good advice, yeah. Right. Just sort of talking, just finally, before we sign off, talking about being in front of the cameras, did you ever get on to Zane Lowe's? We mentioned him on the main pod that you were doing some work for him. Chris, did you ever make it onto the Gonzo couch?
Yeah, actually, that was really weird because... I mean, you know, I was friends with Zane and, you know, I had his number, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But when we were starting our original cat, like, you know, doing our first single, with Fierce Panda, I wasn't phoning around people going, by the way, like, you know, keep your ears to the ground. You know, we sort of went to ground a bit because we were working really hard at that time. We were rehearsing all the time. And so, you know, stuff was going on a bit on radio, but we weren't, you know, sitting there listening to the radio all the time. And then I remember we're in this pub in Camden and we just rehearsed or something like that. And I got this call and it was withheld number. And it was like, Chris. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, it's Zane. I was like, hello, dude, how are you? And he's like, for fuck's sake, you didn't tell me that you're the singer of Boy Kill Boy and that's your band. And I was like, oh yeah, man, like, good to hear from you. How are you doing? I can't really hear you very well. He's like, listen, I'm on the radio show, can you do an interview? And I was like, yeah, like, when? And he was like, 10 minutes, don't swear, I'll be back, you know. And suddenly, you know, I'm out having a fag, and then next thing you know, I'm like, I'm being interviewed for Zane Lowe's show. And, you know, went back in and told the boys, you wouldn't guess what just happened out there, kind of thing. And then he kept his enthusiasm continued, and, you know, made his track of your best song in the world, and
yeah,
you know,
hottest track in the world today, he used to do, didn't he? I think he did that for Civil Sin was one that he picked out for you guys.
Nice.
Richard, you've done your homework. I wish everyone knew their stuff like you did. Exactly. So by the time it was then out, and also, like I said, I left MTV where I was just like a runner, really, intern, you know. And then it was mad because it was like, then we hit, you know, the charts, you know, top 20 or whatever. And then we were interviewed to Gonzo, and I was coming back into the MTV, you know, where I was only a couple of years ago, looking around and recognizing a few people. And there we were going to the couch to do our interview with Zane. It was absolutely brilliant.
I used to love that show. Used to like it was essential viewing back in the day. Yeah. Good stuff, guys. It's been a pleasure talking about the Boy Kill Boy story, and then it's been great fun following up with your sort of reflections on the best music from that era, and then leading us into all sorts of different areas about artwork and photography and what have you, MTV too. Thanks for coming on to the Boys in the Band podcast.
Thanks for having us.
So that's the fun of this feature. We start off by asking a simple question: pick an album from the noughties that you enjoyed. And then we end up talking about all sorts of things from album artwork and band image and how you're portraying yourselves as a band to hanging out with Zane Lowe on the Gonzo sofa. So it's a good starting point. And the Boy Kill Boy guys were great fun on the longer pod and great fun on this little bonus extra as well. Just giving us a little bit insight into all different aspects of being in a big indie band during the noughties.
Yeah, really cool. Particularly like the the chat where it veered into talking about band artwork and the font style and and all the thought that goes into that. And it was really coincidental how we were talking about Blur at the time, and I never really thought about how similar their band logos actually are, that font. But yeah, really interesting. I think there was definitely a common feature amongst a lot of album artwork at that time that did have that kind of like band font or logo at the top, strike an image in the middle, and maybe the title somewhere down the bottom. It seems to be a common theme, and definitely worked. It makes them, you know, pretty recognizable.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how if you go back and listen to bands from that era, in your mind the imagery of the album artwork jumps out at you. And I think it's something we've mentioned on the pod before, where I know bands do still invest time and effort into artwork and time and effort into music videos, for instance, as well. But you know, with music just downloaded so much more now off Spotify as well, that side to things just seems to be lost a little bit from my point of view anyway. I'm sure some people are still very attached to the artwork, but it's an element of that fandom that's maybe been eroded slightly. But another shout out for Banksy as well. Another clue perhaps to add to the pile that Kev's just dropping in. Can we track down who Banksy is through Boy Kill Boy interviews? Maybe we should set up a few more follow-up podcasts with these guys just to eke out a bit more information.
Yeah, really good name drop, that one. And bit more on Zane Lowe as well. You know, another good impression from Chris could really sort of hear Zane Lowe's enthusiasm coming through on that phone call he got from him. He was a really... of that time as well, wasn't he, Zayla? I know he's still doing, you know, plenty these days, but you know, that MTV Gonzo, and then when you got that evening show on Radio 1, hottest record in the world today, every night, you know, that was the place to really discover so much new music at the time.
Yeah, mate, absolutely. It was essential viewing. Like, it was funny where Chris was talking about, you know, walking into the MTV studios and, you know, seeing all these people that you used to work with before going on set. But on set was basically, I mean, for those of you who never watched Gonzo back in the day, it was literally just a sort of battered brown leather sofa in front of some screen playing out weird and random imagery, wasn't it? And in between playing music videos. But he managed to rope in the coolest and most interesting indie artists of the time each week. And it was always good fun watching those shows.
Yeah, absolutely. So talking about the other artists of the indie era, we've got another interview coming up for you this weekend. So make sure you're subscribed and check us out on social media to get a little heads up on who might be dropping Saturday morning.
Well, talk about album artwork, Rich.
Oh, yeah.
There's artwork completed during the podcast. First in the world, artwork created during a Boys in the Band podcast interview.
We were very honoured by this.
Yeah. This artwork could sell for a lot of money one day, given its relationship with this podcast. We will tell you a lot more about this on Saturday when we launch the next podcast. So look out for that one.